100 years ago, between July and November 1917, the fields of Flanders witnessed one of the bloodiest episodes of the First World War. What took place was officially known as the Third Battle of Ypres, but history recalls the horror as Passchendaele. As a pre-war territorial unit, the men of the Harts were part-time soldiers coming from all walks of life. The 1st Battalion Hertfordshire Regiment were the only infantry unit from the county to see service overseas, serving on the Western Front from November 1914. But at Passchendaele, the Hertfordshire Regiment's 620 men and officers were virtually wiped out in the first 2 hours of fighting on July the 31st, 1917. And all the regiment's officers and 75% of the other ranks were either killed, wounded, or captured. To mark the centenary, the Hearts at War Community History Project has unveiled a monument to the Hertfordshire Regiment at the battlefield. Hertfordshire's then Lord Lieutenant, Lady Verulam, was there, and so too was Howard Gard, a deputy lieutenant and the author and director of a film called A County at War, which was made in 2014 to mark Hertfordshire's contribution to the First World War effort. And Howard joins me now. What you did pull out was the personal photographs of, of families who have lived for generations in Hertfordshire. And then the other powerful images came when preparations for war were really being made, and you used a lot of the photographs from the Holland Hibbert family archive. They live near Watford. And those images of, I think his name was Thurston. His wife travelled with him.
To Egypt. And that was quite common, not to France, but definitely to Egypt. It wasn't unusual. She became a nurse, a VAD nurse, which was a volunteer auxiliary. He ended up being wounded at Gallipoli, and although she had come home earlier before he was wounded, she ended up nursing him, and he was quite seriously wounded.
The other thing that surprised me was the influx of refugees. I think when war broke out, the film says that there were 1.5 million refugees who took to the road. And somebody called Lady Lugard actually founded the War Refugees Committee.
In the first days of the war, there was no official news, no television, no telephones for people to say what was happening, where or when. There was just this awful rumblings. And a few refugees came across, and then it suddenly turned into a flood. And she learned all of that from doormen at London clubs. And I've always imagined that the doorman knew what was going on, because the only telephone in the club would be in the lobby, and the doorman would listen to the phone calls that the generals were receiving, because they seemed to be better informed than anybody else. But then there was no BBC. She very quickly sprang into action, and she said this immortal line, "Something must be done."
And she did just that. She founded the War Refugees Committee.
Passant par-dessus la Manche une seconde fois, elle est donc s'était repris en cœur par mille voix. C'est celui que les Tommy chantaient déjà chez nous. Quand ils
In 6 weeks, 200,000 Belgian refugees would arrive.
And she got a group of ladies together, all of whom took 2,000 refugees. And 2,000 came to Letchworth. But within days, very, very quickly. And stayed until 1919.
It's interesting, too, that women at all levels of society played an instrumental role in the First World War, didn't they? I mean, at the higher level, Lady Lytton, I think, opened a hospital at Nebworth.
There's a wonderful photograph of her with Queen Mary, where she invited Queen Mary to watch a female surgeon operate on a man. Now, first of all, there were no female surgeons. At the start of the war, there were only 100 who had passed their exams, and they were mainly gynaecologists and paediatricians. So it was a very unusual thing to have a female surgeon, and it was an entirely inconceivable thing that the Queen would then go and see an operation. And Queen Mary was absolutely wonderful. She was a pillar of strength, and I think, I'm sure, had a great sense of humour as well. I think she wasn't dour in any way, although she had some pretty frightening photographs in her later years. But as a young woman, she was very fetching and very upright and dignified. And I had this photograph of them in the operating theatre. It's just the two of them watching something. And there's a personal bodyguard, a man in a morning dress behind the Queen. and one of her ladies-in-waiting had fainted and gone out. I knew this from the diaries. And I had it for weeks longer. I put it in the film, and then I suddenly saw that her right hand had gone through Lady Lytton's arm. And she was not clinging on because she was feeling wobbly. She was actually, in a very dignified way, saying, "Well done, this is very good." And Lady Lytton is looking down, and she is so startled because she's looking down at this hand, this gloved hand on her elbow. And, of course, royalty didn't go around touching people. So it was a complete surprise to Lady Lytton, and it was a complete surprise to me when I spotted it. Mm. So I covered that by zooming in very slowly towards this black glove. Well, you would never have got that on a film, you see.
No.
So we discovered all kinds of things within the pictures.
Hertfordshire had 38 voluntary aid detachment hospitals, and it is estimated that the volunteers who manned them treated as many as 150,000 men. Without their help, the system would have collapsed.
And at Hatfield House, I think women ran a sort of logging campaign,
yes,
did they?
It was the Women's Voluntary Service and the Women's Land Army, both of which were started by Lady Verulam's grandmother.
And Hatfield House became the sort of centre of this.
Yes, well, by 1917, we were in a lot of trouble because, in fact, while we had managed to blockade Germany and very few supply ships from anywhere in the world were getting through to Germany, it was equally true that the German Navy, their U-boats, were sinking an awful lot of the ships destined for England. So we had real food shortages, but in Germany they had real starvation. I can't remember if it's 700 or 7,000 people actually died of starvation. It's a startling number, even if it was 10.
You mentioned the tanks in the actual Battle of Passchendaele earlier on, but Hatfield House was also the location for a demonstration of this new weapon, the tank.
Yeah.
And I think the Marquess of Salisbury staged this exhibition on his golf course.
He did.
And invited all the great and the good.
Absolutely. And all the doubters and the naysayers, because still, in 1915, horses were judged to be necessary to the army. The vast majority of the general staff didn't get it. They didn't get mechanized transport. There was a very small group in the army who had pursued the possibility of having a mechanized vehicle that could go over very rough ground. And there was a company in Lincolnshire who developed a vehicle with caterpillar tracks. And this was in 1914. So the army said, "No, we don't like it. We don't see them any possibilities here." And they cancelled the order, and they just had one trial vehicle, which they sold to a company in California who changed its name to Caterpillar because the men in the factory had nicknamed this vehicle the Cat. Caterpillar has become one of the biggest companies in the world. And by the end of the war, by 1918, the British government were buying thousands of Caterpillar-tracked vehicles from Caterpillar. And we had sold the rights for nothing. It's a very sobering story that we didn't back our brilliant invention. However, by 1915, the men were dying in vast numbers in no man's land. And the only hope was that there would be something like a tank. We developed the first one in secret, and Lord Salisbury got it down to Hatfield House to sell it to the top brass.
In the dead of night, on January the 27th and 28th, 1916, the weapon, nicknamed Mother, was moved along closed railway lines and roads to Lord Salisbury's private golf course. The Hearts Volunteer Regiment had built a no-man's land, with trenches modelled on the Loos network, shell holes and a swamp. Kitchener came for lunch on February the 2nd. In the following days, King George V, Lloyd George and all the top brass came to visit, and by February the 12th, the army had placed an order for 100 tanks, which saw action on the Somme in September.
Churchill, to be fair, had been involved because he had commissioned it because it was under the Navy. Tanks were judged to be vessels and it was part of the Navy and it carried naval guns. And I suppose there was a certain logic. It also, interestingly, got around people like Haig, who believed staunchly in horses. It was a lot of politicking, and I do believe the Salisburys are quite experienced at that.
Now, Hertfordshire also has several names, well-known names, like de Havilland and Sir Hugh Trenchard, who were instrumental in pioneering, really, the war in the air during the First World War.
And the one figure that really shook me was by the end of the First World War, because we started it with no RAF, so it was the Royal Flying Corps. In 1914, when they advertised for people to come with their own aircraft to qualify to be in the Royal Flying Corps. And they were like kites. They were just like these extraordinary things that one saw in the film, those magnificent men in their flying machines, and that's what they looked like. And they were very slow. And there is the sequence begins in the film with an aircraft flying over Watford in the first ever air race. And there were only two entrants in the air race. And the prize was £10,000, which was a fortune. And the flight was from London to Manchester. So there was this explosion. Necessity is the mother of invention. The war came along. Clearly, aircraft were going to be instrumental in not so much fighting the Red Baron, but actually in spotting what was happening on the ground. Because, again, no satellites, no digital this or that, no visual aids whatsoever. Basically, no idea what was going on. And it was the RAF spotter aircraft that took the aerial photographs and actually reported back in real time. They dropped notes. They used to fly over the lines, scribble a note giving a compass point, and drop it with a stone or something. But it made a huge difference. So these are all men that rode this colossal tide of invention. And by the end of the war, we had the biggest air force in the whole world. And it was now finally called the Royal Air Force. And a nice anecdote is that the royal family immediately saw the interest here, and they all got fitted for RAF uniforms. Everywhere they went, they started appearing in RAF uniform.
Of all the stories that emerge in the film that you made, one is very powerful, and it's the story of Private Percy Buck. And I suppose I found it very remarkable because while well-known families, established families in the county, keep archives of their own and, of course, have all these sort of photographs and mementos from the war, Percy Buck was just a private in the army. But you unearthed his story, quite a sad one. He died at Passchendaele.
This recording of Abide With Me was sung at the burial of the unknown soldier in Westminster Abbey on the 11th of November 1920. He lies beside the tombs of the kings of England. Private Percy Buck was one of the 128 men of the Hertfordshire Regiment who died at Saint-Julien that have no known grave. The Menin Gate is their only memorial. Percy had died of his wounds during the night and was found the next day by a German soldier in a shell hole. He was clutching a photo of his wife and three-year-old son. On the back was his address. The German took the photo, together with Percy's identification, and returned it to Mrs. Buck in Hitchin via the Swiss Red Cross. Because of this act of kindness, Percy's body could not be identified, and his grave was unrecorded. Another unknown soldier.
This story is sad at every single turn because the chances are he wasn't mortally wounded. He was wounded in the side, clearly didn't kill him. He was seen by his comrades falling into a shell hole, and he was found sitting up looking at his wife's photograph, who was holding their baby son. The German soldier obviously found it very poignant and handed it to the German Red Cross, who handed it to the Swiss Red Cross, and it eventually found its way back to England. But because his dog tags were removed and his identity papers were removed from his body, his grave was never marked. He is an unknown soldier. That was very poignant because there we were in the field where he obviously died, but nobody knows where his remains are.
And how did you come across the story?
Well, that is also sad because all those papers were in a tin in a loft. His wife never remarried. their son found it when his mother died, and it was in the loft in a tin. And she had never mentioned it. But that, again, is a story in itself, because this war produced an entire generation of widows or spinsters. A huge number of men died, but a huge number of women lost any possibility of marriage and or having children. And that's very much an untold story.
I mentioned that you made this film in 2014. I think you're now planning an update, a slightly different ending.
The present ending is profoundly sad. In my attempts to bind it to Hertfordshire and to give the film some structure rather than just an endless catalogue of stories and pictures, we designed maps of Hertfordshire in which we then superimposed things that had happened. So the number of wounded men, the number of men that were lost at Saint-Julien, that appears in a map, which then fades to black at the end and very, very movingly tells the story of a quartermaster who arrived with supplies to deliver to the Hertfordshire Regiment, and he went up to the staff officer and said, "I'm looking for the Hertfordshires." And the answer came back, "There is no Hertfordshire Regiment." So that's a map of Hertfordshire covered with hundreds of crosses in red or white for wounded or dead or missing. We also have one of all the nurses, because there were hospitals everywhere, every large country house. There were just dozens and dozens of impromptu hospitals, which we estimate treated 150,000 men. The maps are all sort of aerial, and things happen within them. And we plot the course of a Zeppelin that attacked Barnet and Cuffley. And we also see that Zeppelin being shot down by Leif Robertson, all from still photographs, actually, but animated still photographs. So it was very challenging to do and very fruitful, very satisfying, much, much better than any real footage that we could have ever got. And then we end with the map of Hertfordshire, and three young cadets, Army, Navy and Air Force, are collecting photographs of war memorials, and they stick them on the wall. And there is, in principle, one for every village in Hertfordshire. It reflects the huge number of war memorials in all their different shapes and sizes. And I thought I would try and continue that thought. So the new ending begins with the war memorials in Belgium, and they see the oceans of graves that spread out across the Belgian landscape. And that is also incredibly moving, because it actually brings it all home. I think it is possibly difficult to relate to a stone cross in a market square where, you know, you might sit and do your shoelaces up or eat a sandwich. People just pass by war memorials here in England. But my goodness, you can't pass the cemeteries by without really thinking, wow. So as I said, whether it be 20 men or 20,000 that died there and that are buried, the war grave cemeteries are deeply moving. And so this is what that sequence is about. And it ends with Lady Verulam laying a wreath at the Menin Gate. This sequence then is introduced by the new Lord Lieutenant. So again, it's a reminder that life marches resolutely on. And I think, therefore, it's a more optimistic ending.